software firms are taking advantage of young programmers. Nick Alexander of Virgin Games, a spin-off of the highly successful Virgin Record Company, has an explanation for the kind of long-term contractual obligation which he seeks from contributors.
We feel that we need that in order to try and build a program author as some sort of celebrity or star, that it takes time. You can't do it overnight.
But do you really think it's fair to be tying a 14, 15, 16-year-old to a contract for 3 years?
If they feel, and if their parents and if their legal advisors feel that it doesn't, then they obviously won't sign the contract, and that's their right to do. And we always recommend that and we don't get 14-year-olds in and bribe them with gobstoppers and you know, say, here you are, sign this. And we do try and get the family and their legal advisors, solicitors involved in the thing, so they are going in with open eyes.
Although offers of £1,000 advance have been known to cause even parents and solicitors to blink, which puts a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of the programmer and his or her advisers. At the age of 16, Keith Mitchell was offered a long-term contract. His grandmother, Sylvia Hoffman, had some experience of business affairs, but even so, she found the document daunting in its use of both legal and computer terminology.
One of the things they wanted to do was to tie him for 5 years, but eventually, in the event, this was reduced to 3 years because 5 years was far too long. He was 16, and it would have taken him to 21, and it seemed an awful time to tie him.
And that would have meant that he had to offer everything he made in terms of
everything,
programs.
Every program he compiled, he would have had to offer to the company, and they had the right to refuse it. That was very one-sided.
Keith, I suppose when you were offered the contract, you would have signed anything because you were so pleased at having your programme accepted.
Well, basically I was, but I was still a bit worried about being tied down. You hear about all these kids being conned by the big businesses and all the pop stars who have been screwed out of most of their money by the big pop firms. And I was rather worried, but I was very eager to sign because it's new for me and very exciting getting this money for my game. But I was still worried. I wouldn't have signed it if I was told not to, because they were gonna screw me out of a lot of money.
There are companies that are in it for a fast buck, and they don't care who they wipe out on the way. If a 16-year-old happens to fail his O-levels or A-levels because he happens to be writing programs, do they worry? I doubt it very much.
Well, that report by Michael Shields certainly seems to indicate that some youthful software wizards are in danger of being fairly comprehensively ripped off. Now, is there anything they can do about it, or must they simply put the whole sorry business down to experience? Well, with me now is Alistair Kelman, a barrister who specialises in international computer law, and that in itself must be a comparatively new profession. Alistair, I suppose once they're 18 and they've signed a contract, they're adults, and that's that, but infants in law are people under 18, aren't they? Now, what can the under-18s do if they've signed a contract which they feel is unsatisfactory?
They can effectively tear up the contract, because the law protects an infant from his own folly. And even just after their 18th birthday, they can do the same thing.
Now, what redress, then, would the infant, as it were, have against the company? I mean, how much money could he get back if he thought he'd been, as it were, robbed?
Well, he could basically get all the profits that the company has made. And if they carried on after notification of the withdrawal of the copyright in the work, he might even get a higher rate than that. He might even get all the sums of money that the company receives for the sale of that particular program.
But the first thing to do then for any of these people is, if they feel they're not getting a fair deal, the first thing obviously is to go and take legal advice.
Yes, most definitely. But one fact is important. If the infant's father is a signature to the agreement, that in itself is not going to mean that the agreement is good, because if the infant is intending to pay money into the family household through the earnings he's making, and the father knows of this, then that means that the father's signature doesn't strengthen the agreement one bit.
The next question, of course, is how is a teenager to know if the contract he's offered is fair? Well, we can help here, I think, because Alistair Kelman has been talking with the contracts manager of the National Computing Centre, John Morris, and Mr. Morris is in our Manchester studio now. Mr. Morris, what emerged from your talks with Alistair Kelman?
Well, what we've decided to do at NCC is to prepare an information pack for use of people who are in this position. And really what it contains are some brief notes on copyright law, which is how you protect computer programs. There are notes on the appointment of a distributor. There's a form of acknowledgement you'll be able to get the distributor to sign to protect you against his pinching your ideas and develop them for himself. And finally, we've put forward a form of contract which would be applicable. We don't say that it's the only definitive contract there can be, but it can be used as a checklist and a means of getting the agent to agree to reasonable conditions, and it may well be a useful aid to your own legal advisor in what is rather an arcane area of the law to many practitioners.
So that specimen contract is something which you would advise people to take to their own solicitor before they enter into any other kind of contract with a software manufacturer?
Yes, indeed.
Fine. Mr. Morris, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Now, two things seem to arise from all that. First, if you'd like a free copy of that contract, do send for our fact sheet. And secondly, if you happen to be a software wizard and you have reason to believe that you too are being ripped off, then please let us know. We can't guarantee anything, but we'll certainly look into the matter for you. Now then, at the beginning of this programme, I announced the introduction of the Chip Shop Takeaway Service, a magnificently generous offer which comes to you absolutely free. What we're going to do is to broadcast software, and all you have to do is accept it, gratefully or otherwise, depending on your nature, as it comes to you over the airwaves. As you probably know, home computers store their programmes on an ordinary domestic cassette, and that being so, there's no reason at all why we shouldn't broadcast a cassette which you can record and use. Every make of computer stores its programs in a different way, so to cater for, let us say, the 20 most popular models, we'd have to broadcast 20 different programs, and we'd all be up half the night. So that was a non-starter, and another good idea seemed to have bitten the dust until... Enter the Dutch.
Populaire elektronica, computers, communicatie en stereofonie. Dit is NOS Hobbyscope.
The Hobbyscope programme, which is broadcast by the Dutch domestic service, NOS, came up one day with a clever wheeze, which, like most clever wheezes, is really very simple, a form of Esperanto for computers. And from there it was but a step to Basicode, an international computer language, now in use in the Netherlands, Belgium, West Germany, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and at last, the UK. And what it means is that we can broadcast a short programme that will be understood by the majority of the most popular home computers. Now, you obviously would love to know how this works, and as a matter of fact, so would I. And that's precisely what we're going to do, because on the line now from Hilversum is Jonathan Marks, producer of the Radio Netherlands programme Media Networks. Jonathan, how exactly does Basicode work?
Well, the standard itself is made up of two tones. There's one at 1200 hertz, like this, which we use to represent a zero, and a higher one at 2400 hertz, like this, which represents a 1. Put them together and you get this, which is in fact at a speed of 4, very, very slow. So we have to speed it up. This is around 50 baud now. That's about the speed of telex stations, and you can find similar sounding noises if you switch on a shortwave radio. But let's speed it up again. That's 300 baud, but although we're now at a reasonable rate, it's still too slow for use on the air. So let's multiply everything by 4, and we get this noise, the sound of Basicode at 1200 baud.
How long have you been doing that now in the Netherlands?
Well, the whole computing standard was thought up back in 1979 when the Dutch domestic radio service realised they couldn't spend hours of national radio airtime just making funny noises to interest a handful of computing enthusiasts. And we had to serve as many people at the same time. Since then, of course, it's been developed. In the 4 years of its existence, there have been improvements in its capabilities and ironing out of the incompatibility problems.
And generally speaking, what's the reaction been like in the Netherlands? You're talking about a handful of enthusiasts. Presumably there are far more than that now.
Well, since we've got Basicode, we reckon that about 45%, perhaps even 50% of the people that have home computers in the Netherlands are using Basicode.
Well, that's pretty impressive. Jonathan, thank you very much. Right, so that's Basicode, that's our computer Esperanto, and having grasped all that, this is what you do. First, you'll need a cassette with the translation programme on it. I said all this was going to be free, didn't I? Well, I lied. You'll have to pay for the Basicode kit, which consists of a cassette and a handbook, and will cost you £3.95, a mere bagatelle when you think of all the free software you'll be able to acquire once you're properly equipped. The cassette, incidentally, includes a whole range of translation programmes from which you can select the one you need for your own machine. In fact, it's suitable for the Acorn Electron, Apple II and IIe, BBC models A and B, Commodore 64, VIC-20, Sharp MZ-80A, Tandy TRS-80, Video Genie, Sinclair ZX-81, and available from March, the Sinclair Spectrum. Now then, how do you get the Basic Code kit? Dead easy. All you do is send us a stamped addressed envelope, an A4 envelope with a 21 pence stamp, and we'll send you the fact sheet, which contains, among other information, details of Basic Code and an order form. We'll be broadcasting our software 4 nights a week, on Saturdays, Sundays, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, after the shipping forecast at about 23 minutes past midnight. If you have access to a CFAX television, you'll find details of the chip shop on page 703, and this week's software broadcast on page 710. All right, well, at this stage, of course, you won't yet have a Basic Code kit. In fact, it would be astonishing if you did, because I've only just told you about it. But don't worry, you can still record our takeaway programs and use them later when the cassette and the book arrive. But now, let's move on to our weekly news roundup. Eventually, I suppose, every nation will have its own thriving computer industry, but for the moment, three countries are still comfortably ahead of the rest, Britain, Japan and the USA. So let's start with Japan. On the line now from Tokyo is William Horsley. William, why is Japan so significant in the computer market?
Well, Japan's made it a sort of national goal to succeed in computers and related areas. In fact, Japan's the second largest computer market in the world after America, and it's the only one where a domestic computer company, Fujitsu in fact, has a bigger share of the home market than the giant IBM does. And then there's the much publicized fifth generation computer project, which made the whole world sit up when it was unveiled in 1981. The aim of that is within 10 years to produce a totally new kind of computer with artificial intelligence, a machine that can do things that at the moment we think of as being reserved for human beings, like speaking and understanding speech and making intelligent inductions. That's an awesome undertaking, and there'll be an international conference later this year to report the results so far.
Well, that indeed, William, sounds like something to make the rest of the world sit up. So next, let's go over to Robin Webster, who's waiting to talk to us from Silicon Valley in California. Robin, how's America reacting to what's going on in Japan?
Well, Barry, they're feeling very much under attack here in the U.S. In fact, they're expecting a bit of an invasion here within the next few months. This area, Silicon Valley, is called that because the silicon microchip was pioneered here in the early 1970s by companies like Intel. That was just about 10 years ago, and the Valley is now home to hundreds of successful computer companies, and there are well over 3 million personal computers sold in the U.S. each year.
Well, it sounds as if it's hectic not only in the USA, but also in Japan. I wonder how hectic is it here? Well, with me in the studio is Jane Bird, the editor of Personal Computer World, and she'll be joining me each week with news of what's happening and how it affects us in the UK. So, Jane, what is new?
Well, we've seen the launch of a new computer from Sinclair called the QL and costing under £400.
Well, that is actually quite a breakthrough, isn't it, in price anyway?
Well, it is in this area because up till now we've really only seen home computers aimed very much at the hobbyist, lots of games, a bit of educational software, an attempt at word processing. But this is the first time we've really seen a serious professional computer coming in at under £400.
So what is different? What's particular about it?
Well, they've made a very big effort to produce a machine which will be usable by a non-expert, somebody who's got a serious application, who's doing some sort of writing at home, for instance, and who wants to use word processing, or who's got files, names and addresses. Perhaps small businessmen who want to get their files onto a computer and haven't done so up till now. And what they've done is they've tried to make the software very user-friendly so that people will be able to actually leap in and use the machine without having to learn all kinds of nasty programming languages.
I love that phrase, user-friendly, but I do understand now what it means. And I find this very encouraging because I think there must be lots of people like me who do find that the program language is just too complex to come to terms with. But in what sense is this one particularly user-friendly?
Well, one particularly friendly feature is the Windows.
No, you've lost me already, Jane. What is a window?
Well, a window allows you to look at what's happening in a particular program which is running at any one time. And the marvellous thing about this particular computer is that it can do lots of things simultaneously. The facility is called multitasking, and not only can it perform all the tasks simultaneously, but it can actually show you a window on what's happening in that area on the screen. And indeed, you can have as many windows as there are lines on the screen, so you can be watching up to 20, 24 things going on at once.
Well, all this sounds absolutely splendid, but it seems to me that the computer industry is always claiming that it's made another enormous breakthrough and this is going to be cheaper and better and all the rest of it. But when you actually go to the shops and try and buy one of the machines, you find there's a waiting list that goes on forever. Now, is that going to be true in this case?
Well, perhaps. What we've got so far are just prototypes and demonstration models. Sinclair is claiming to be getting production under line straight away, hoping to reach 20,000 units by summer. And they're hoping to ship first units to people who order them straight away at the end of February. However, I would regard that as perhaps rather optimistic. Perhaps it'd be a better idea to think of later on in the spring if you seriously want to order one now.
Jane, thank you very much. See you next week. And now to our competition. Together with the Listener magazine, we're giving away a BBC Model B microcomputer plus £50 worth of software. A real gift, this, because the competition is a doddle. All you have to do is answer a few simple questions and write a limerick. Oh, and we don't want any filth. I know it's difficult because of the very nature of the things not to write limericks that are dirty, suggestive or extremely risque, but do try. Right then, for the first competition, we'd like you to send us a limerick with the first line beginning, "A programming genius called." OK, a programming genius called, and you take it from there, but keep it clean. Well, cleanish. Entries as soon as possible, please. The entry form and all the details, including the questions, are in the Listener. We'll announce the results and read out any limerick suitable for a sensitive and well-brought-up audience in a fortnight's time. And that's just about all from the chip shop for tonight, except for this little item. Let me ask you, what did you think of our signature tune? Pretty cute, eh? Well, I don't imagine you'd be altogether astonished to learn that it was composed entirely on a computer. Tessa Shaw went to the BBC's radiophonic workshop to find out how it was done.
Well, this is very special. It can not only do all the things that conventional synthesizers can do, it can do a great deal besides. One of the most useful things it can do is to sample real sounds. That is to say that you can, via a microphone, put real sounds into it, like a dog barking or the sound of a wine glass being pinged, and play a tune on it, because they then appear on a keyboard.
The device looks rather strange, a hybrid of computer and electric organ. There's a screen, floppy disks to store the programme and the music, a conventional typewriter keyboard, and a piano keyboard as well. Here we can only demonstrate a fraction of what's possible using this computer synthesizer. But to give you a flavour of what it can do, Nick first selected a piece recently composed for the Woman's Hour programme. They wanted a tune to introduce their letter spot, and so Roger Lim, another composer at the Radiophonic Workshop, thought what more appropriate for a letters tune than the sound of typewriters. The raw, natural sounds were fed into the computer using a microphone. There they were converted to a digital signal and stored on floppy disk. Nick takes up the story.
We've got ordinary typewriting sounds like this. We've got the bell and the carriage return. And lastly, we've got the paper coming out of the carriage itself.
Those sounds were played on a piano-style keyboard. It looked very bizarre. Hit middle C and you hear the sound of a typewriter. If the sounds of dogs had been stored on the floppy disks, playing the keys would have produced barks, all correctly pitched and ready to perform.
Well, you can play them all up and down the keyboard. I mean, for example, this one with the paper coming out. You can play it all over the place. Now, I mean, that's great fun, but you might not think that's terribly useful. But I'll give you an example. In fact, play you the signature tune, and you can see how it all fits together. Okay, so that's the basic rhythmic or percussive part to it, which sounds a bit boring on its own. But what Roger did is build on top of that and put a little tune on top, which sounds like this.
The computer will let you build up to 8 parts at a time. That's just like having 8 musicians lined up, or 8 well-trained dogs, or 8 tuneful typists. Each part can be created either by capturing a natural sound, such as the typewriter, and then producing a musical scale of typewriters. Or you can create electronic notes, just like the conventional synthesizer. The music is built up on the screen a bar at a time, and is displayed in conventional music notation. As a bar is composed, it's filed away onto the floppy disk, and work begins on the next bar.
The other advantage of something like this, of course, is that you might say, you could do that by just recording that on a tape machine and playing each bit separately. But you've got ultimate flexibility with this. Another lot of sounds that we've got loaded in are birdsong, and you could actually play the tune with the sound of birdsong instead of the sound of typewriters.
That's for airmail letters. But how about the signature tune for this programme? How did Nick approach that?
Well, I took two basic sounds. I took this sound for the bass line and this sound for the melody. Now, the beauty of this machine is the fact that that's not just the only sound it can play. It can play a whole keyboard of the first sound. And it can play a whole keyboard of the second sound. So from the second sound, I made the bass line, which goes like this. And from the first sound, I played the melody, which goes like this. So you can hear, although it doesn't sound that great, it is actually now resembling the signature tune.
The computer has many more facilities we can't cover here. For instance, you can draw a waveform on the screen using a light pen, and it'll play it. You can redraw existing waveforms. You can manipulate sounds and tones in all manner of cunning ways. And when you've produced a masterpiece, the computer will even print out the music score. This, then, is the final result. Produced by one man, one computer, and just two sounds.
And that really is all for tonight. Don't forget to send in for the fact sheet and do drop in for another look round the chip shop at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye.
The Chip Shop was presented by Barry Norman and produced by Trevor Taylor. And the address for the Chip Shop's 18-page fact sheet is fact sheet number 1, the Chip Shop, BBC London, W12 8QT, and you should enclose an A4 size envelope, self-addressed and stamped with a 21 pence stamp. Now, computer software will be broadcast after the shipping forecast tonight and tomorrow night, and that's at approximately 23 minutes past midnight. And you can hear a longer edition of the Chip Shop on Tuesday night at 11 o'clock on VHF only. Now, there's an article by David Dawson on computer fraud in the current issue of The Listener. And if you can't get a copy of next week's Listener for the Chip Shop competition, then you can get one by sending a cheque or postal order for 50 pence to Vector, Wellingborough, Northants, NN8 2LR. And please mark your envelope, Listener.